Good morning and welcome to Studio 619. I'm Rick Heldet. Coming up in a few minutes, Heidi Caravan talks about the status of Louisville's immigrant and refugee services with Assistant U.S. Secretary of State Ellen Sauerbrey. First, the Commonwealth of Kentucky has a new leader as of last week. Steve Beshear became Kentucky's 61st governor Tuesday. 80 marching bands and 150 horses helped to usher him into office in an inaugural parade, which was followed by his first public speech as governor. Here is that address in its entirety.
Honored and distinguished guests and my fellow Kentuckians, before my formal address, Jane and I want to acknowledge and extend sincere appreciation to the many who have made this day possible. To our supporters in every county and elsewhere, you were magnificent. To a very special campaign staff, along with countless volunteers, our heartfelt thanks. To my Lieutenant Governor, Daniel Mangiardo, your energy, winning attitude, and friendship are very special attributes. Thank you. To our transition team members, what an outstanding job you performed in such a very, very short time. And for making this inaugural day such a wonderful day, our gratitude goes to Chairs Wade and Alice Houston and Tracy and Carol Farmer, to Executive Director Mike Cooper, Event Coordinator Carol Mitchell, Program Coordinator Bob Stewart and Treasurer Lindy Carnes, and to each and every committee chair, along with every inaugural committee volunteer. No one in this entire country could have done this better. Thank you so much. My fellow Kentuckians, once more, our Commonwealth is at a crossroads. The course we set out upon today will help to determine whether or not we pass on to our children and grandchildren a Kentucky that's better and more prosperous and more promising than the one we live in today. We can choose the path of least resistance, the status quo, or we can choose the path of progress. That path will involve new thinking and new ideas. It will require cooperation and patience, and it will demand courage. The status quo is unacceptable to me. There is too much to do. We need to act. We often look at the past to find clues to the future. Our challenge as Kentuckians is to hold fast to the values that embody Kentucky's past and learn from them as we create our own future. Kentucky was America's first frontier, the first state west of the Appalachians. Our ancestors succeeded by creating opportunities, working hard, building communities, and putting their faith in God and each other. That is the legacy they left to us. And we need to get back to those values so that we can be proud of the legacy that we leave to our own children. However, in many ways, the Kentucky of today has stood still while others have moved ahead. When it comes to economic and educational opportunities, Kentucky has fallen behind. When it comes to investing in our people, we have too often fallen short. When it comes to hope for the future, we've become resigned to watching helplessly as many of our children move to other states where better opportunities beckon them. But it doesn't have to stay that way. If we address the challenges that face us and take bold steps to meet them, I believe I believe that we can make Kentucky America's next frontier, a frontier of imaginative solutions, a frontier of new technologies and new industries, a frontier that protects the environment while creating opportunities, a frontier that attracts entrepreneurs, tourists, and retirees, and a frontier that keeps our graduates right here at home in Kentucky. My administration will be about our shared future. We have a responsibility to work together, and I have a responsibility to lead. I take that responsibility very seriously because our prosperity is at stake. I ask everyone in this Commonwealth, Democrats, Republicans, Independents, white, black, brown, from Pikeville to Paducah, from our bustling cities to our small towns to our farms, both large and small, I ask everyone to join hands with me in meeting this challenge. We have come through that time-honored American right of a hard-fought campaign. As a result, it is easy to see what divides us. Instead, what I want to see, and what I do see here today, is what unites us. As Kentuckians and as Americans, we share the same basic values. We're passionate about our freedom. We celebrate our differences. We cherish our faith, and we love our families. Our history is filled with examples of overcoming division. During the Civil War, our Commonwealth was split between those siding with the Confederacy and those favoring the Union. The years following the war were hard, but our ancestors came together to build the foundation for a modern Kentucky. Eventually, they worked through their differences for the sake of the future. It is time to focus once again on what unites us, because only then will we achieve truly great things. Abraham Lincoln, whose 200th birthday we will begin to celebrate some 2 months from now, said in his first presidential inaugural address, "We are not enemies, but friends. We must not be enemies. Though passion may have strained, it must not break our bonds of affection." Lincoln's plea for unity in 1861 is no less relevant today. While we've made extraordinary progress as a people since that time, we must still work to overcome our differences and not allow them to impede our progress. 60 years earlier, in his 1801 inaugural address, Thomas Jefferson said, "Every difference of opinion is not a difference of principle." Now, some may disagree with me on some of my opinions, but let's agree on principles and goals. We can accomplish much over the next 4 years, but only if we work together for the common good. Only if we're open about the challenges we face and honest about the solutions. Only if we're open to new ideas and new ways of thinking. And my friends, only if we put the interest of all Kentuckians ahead of the interest of political parties, individuals, and special interests. The great Kentucky Senator Henry Clay said, "Government is a trust, and the officers of government are trustees, and both the trust and the trustees are created for the benefit of the people." Let us remember those wise words as we begin the difficult and exciting task of creating a new Kentucky for the 21st century. A Kentucky where the youngest among us have expanded learning opportunities that will serve a lifetime. A Kentucky where the oldest among us are not forced to choose between food and medicine. A Kentucky where citizens trust that their leaders are doing the people's business, not their own. And a Kentucky where it doesn't matter if an idea is a Democratic idea or a Republican idea, as long as it is a good idea. My administration will be looking for good ideas to help Kentucky innovate and become a leader among the states. I expect to earn your trust, not to be simply given it. I expect my administration to be accountable, and it starts at the top with me. That's why one of my first official acts as governor will be to require all of my top appointees to take extensive training in laws relating to ethics and the merit system, and to pledge to follow them. In addition, one of my first proposals to the legislature will be a package of new ethics laws to govern us, increasing penalties for violating the ethics code, strengthening protections for whistleblowers, and changing the way appointments to the Ethics Commission itself are made. We need to get our own house in order before we can be trusted to do the people's business. I look forward to working with legislators of both parties to pass tough new ethics and accountability standards that we can all be proud of. We've seen too often what happens when the government loses trust, when the people lose trust in their government. Enacting new ethics standards will help to regain some of that trust. So will governing effectively, efficiently, and with humility. And that I pledge to you to do. And that starts with being honest about the serious challenges we face as I take office today. The current state of the economy means that we will need to be jealous guardians of the public's money. We will need to make difficult choices and set clear priorities. We will need to show the courage to cut back where we can now in order to invest in what we must in the future. My priorities are ones we all share. Investing more in the education of our people to better prepare them to compete in this global economy. Creating more opportunities by attracting better paying jobs throughout Kentucky in industries that promise long-term growth, not just for today's workers, but also for tomorrow's. And making health care more affordable for all of our people, so that every family can provide their children the care they deserve, and so no senior need ever go without the medication they need. We must address these challenges if we are to preserve and protect our quality of life and build the future that we all hope for, a future where our children don't need to move away to find good-paying jobs with benefits, a future where new ideas will create new opportunities and new industries, a future where Kentucky is competing not just with our neighbors, but with the entire world. I see Kentucky as one big family. We may have our disagreements, but we share the same values, and we want what's best for our children and our grandchildren, and we want to keep our families together. Wouldn't it be something if we could build a Kentucky that our children would not want to leave and that would attract many others because of the opportunity we would offer them here. The Bible states in Jeremiah chapter 31, verse 17, "There is hope for your future, says the Lord, and your children shall come back to their own land." That, my friends, would be something. This inauguration is a new beginning. Now is the time to put aside our preconceived notions and our ideologies. Instead, let us strive to work with those who differ with us and forge new alliances. Let us consider new ideas and revisit old ones. Let us demand excellence and honesty. And let us listen. For if we listen, we will never forget why we're here or who we're here to serve. I will never forget that I serve the people of the Commonwealth of Kentucky. Thank you. God bless you. Now, let's get to work. Thank you.
That was Kentucky's new governor, Steve Beshear, in his inaugural address. It was delivered Tuesday afternoon in Frankfort. Coming up, Heidi Caravan talks with Assistant U.S. Secretary of State Ellen Sauerbrey. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Rick Howlett. Coming up a little later in the show, Robin Fisher talks with Alan DeSantis about his book, Inside Greek U. First, during a trip to Louisville earlier this month, Assistant U.S. Secretary of State Ellen Sauerbrey said she was impressed with services for refugees here. Sauerbrey met with officials from Kentucky Refugee Ministries and Catholic Charities, as well as some refugees who've settled in Louisville. She chatted about her trip with WFPL's Heidi Caravan.
Thanks so much for speaking with us today. We really appreciate it.
It's a pleasure to be in Louisville and to have an opportunity to visit with the major resettlement offices here. The refugee program here in the United States is a very generous one, but it's also very much focused on creating self-sufficiency on the part of refugees and getting them standing on their own 2 feet and taking responsibility for themselves and their families as quickly as possible.
How do you feel about Louisville? We have a really neat, diverse community here. You can tell, this is kind of a crazy thing to say, but you can tell by our restaurants. We have a wonderful community of people who have come here from other countries that have been forced out of their country. How do you feel about Louisville when it comes to refugees making their home here?
Well, I was just so very impressed by the dedication of the staff and the number of volunteers that do everything from helping refugees with their learning of English to providing child care so moms can study. It's very much a welcoming community that has opened its arms and its hearts to people from all over the world, and I think it's terrific. Louisville also has two very important qualities for successful resettlement, and that is a housing market that is affordable and a lot of opportunities for employment.
We do have a wonderful cost of living here, certainly. What do you think we should be doing differently?
I think that from what I could see, the programs are functioning very well. There's always things that you learn from visiting resettlement offices around the country. For example, they have a what would be sort of like a goodwill that is run by the resettlement office, where people in the church communities, people in the community at large, can donate things that refugees would need. They don't have to buy them from other sources. I think that is something that could be considered. We are going to take an idea back to Washington that was given to me yesterday from Catholic Charities, that they have difficulty finding interpreters when they get new refugee populations. Once a refugee population is established, as for example here now the Karen who have come from the camps and the Burmese refugees from Thailand, so they have a community that can produce its own interpretation for others that are coming. But when you start a new group, like this year, we will be bringing in Bhutanese for the first time, having a national database of interpreters that we could be helping to provide names of available people who speak in what might be very hard-to-find languages. That was something I'll take away from this visit, is something that we can perhaps do better.
That's a great idea. Is there anything else we could share nationally besides the translators? Is there something that Louisville's doing that's very unique? Or is there something that somebody else is doing that we could use here?
I think the marriage of child care and English training that I saw here was especially good. There was a recognition that giving English classes when mothers have children and they have to have something to do with the children while they go study English has led to the creation here, marrying those two things, where the mothers come in with their children and they spend the first hour playing, singing, learning English through song and through games with the children. And then the mothers leave the children in the care of volunteers and a staff member. And the mothers are able then to, for the next 2 hours, to focus completely on their English training. And I thought that was a very good idea that I hadn't seen really done in quite that way. In another state, I saw a recognition that refugees often come from very stressful situations, and that sometimes creates problems in terms of domestic violence and problems with just family relationships in general. And so that's, in that particular situation, they had a focused program for families to sort of work on child care issues and family relationships. I think that's a good idea that can be incorporated in other programs.
How can the United States serve abroad in providing aid to refugees?
Well, the U.S. is the largest provider of assistance to refugees, both abroad and through our resettlement program. We fund about 25% of the UN High Commission for Refugees budget, and we provide through our funding for everything from water and sanitation and health care, protection, education. We are certainly the largest funder of assistance. We also selectively fund NGOs that do particular specialized kinds of services in refugee camps. Two-thirds of the budget of my office, I have an office that has a $1 billion budget, and two-thirds of the budget of my office really goes for assistance to people in refugee situations to make the quality of their life better. But also equally important is to make sure that the social service network of the country in which the refugees are hosted doesn't fall apart under the strain. If you look, for example, today at the Iraq outflow, and you look at a small country like Jordan that has about 500,000 refugees that it has to address. If it were not for international assistance, the Jordanian government social services network would collapse. And we play a very important role in funding directly to Jordan through USAID, through the UNHCR, and through NGOs, assistance for education and healthcare particularly, but a wide range of services.
You had mentioned the Bhutanese earlier. Do you foresee any other group that will be coming to our shores in the near future?
Refugee flows really depend on world events, although there are many localized situations. The Sudan-Chad-Darfur issue would be one that we're looking at. Is there a way that we can safely begin a resettlement program from Sudan? Up to now, we haven't been able to do that because the security situation is so tenuous and the attacks on humanitarian workers make it unsafe for us to be able to send our officials that would have to do the screening in. So that's one that we're focused on looking at in the future. How can we do? But we did not expect a year ago, we did not expect the Iraq outflow that we have seen. And so that has driven our program in one direction. We're watching very carefully what's happening with Kosovo, and hoping that when Kosovo declares independence, which we expect it will in the next, within the next 2 months, that it is peaceful. But we don't know that there couldn't be problems in Kosovo that would cause people to start fleeing. So those are the kinds of things that drive our program. We also are very focused on protracted refugee situations like the Bhutanese that had been in these camps for such a long time, and trying to address these long-term problems before hopelessness and radicalism festers and creates problems that often can spill far beyond the borders of the country in which these terrorist groups get a footing.
It has to be difficult to everything from planning a budget to thinking what you're going to do a month down the road, because I guess a lot of the work is we don't know what's going to happen here. We don't know what's going to happen in Kosovo. How do you plan for the unexpected?
You're right. That is one of our biggest challenges, because the way the federal budget cycle works, we're doing a budget now for fiscal year 2009 and having to try to foresee and guess at where we need to put our resources. With that understanding, you would recognize that we do a certain amount of contingency planning, but a lot of the funding is going to come from supplementals that Congress will give us when we see a situation develop that wasn't expected. We also do have an emergency account that is part of our regular budget cycle, and that emergency account is one that we can draw on when there's, for example, an unexpected crisis, a breakdown in the food pipeline for a particular country because of unexpected drought or floods or, you know, those sorts of things that impact refugees as well.
Assistant U.S. Secretary of State Ellen Sarbrae, thanks so much for speaking with us today. I really enjoyed it.
Sure. Thank you very much.
That was Assistant U.S. Secretary of State Ellen Sarbrae. She spoke with WFPL's Heidi Caravan. Greek life can have a profound impact on a student's college career. Robin Fisher gets the details from Inside Greek U author Alan DeSantis when we return. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Rick Heldon. Coming up in a few minutes, Daniel Gillum talks with the winner of this year's Grawemeyer Award for Music Composition. First, in the mid-1980s, University of Kentucky professor Alan DeSantis was a student at James Madison University and a fraternity member. Little did he know at the time, fraternities and sororities would become a focus of his adult life. This year, DeSantis published his first book, Inside Greek U, Fraternities, Sororities, and the Pursuit of Pleasure, Power, and Prestige. WFPL's Robin Fisher spoke with DeSantis about fraternities, sororities, and how belonging to a Greek organization affects the lives of the students involved.
I want to start with a little background on the book, if you could tell us a little bit about it and why you chose to write it.
Okay. Well, actually, I've been a Greek for as long as I can remember. When I was a freshman at James Madison University in Virginia, I was fascinated with Greek culture and Greek life, and I rushed and pledged like so many millions of American men and women do. I graduated and went on to graduate school, and about 15 years ago, I ended up at the University of Kentucky, and I had, for the most part, forgotten about the earlier days, the more irresponsible days of Greek life, because graduate school had been, of course, so demanding and all-encompassing. But after about my first 2 or 3 months or so on campus, I was asked by quite a few Greek organizations to get involved and become a faculty sponsor. And word quickly spread that I was an ex-Greek who was passionate about Greek life. And so before I knew it, I was working with the large majority of white Greek organizations on campus in one capacity or the next. So I was firmly grounded in the Greek community, but for years and years I had been wrestling with the assets and the liabilities of Greek life, because although the fraternity experience was a valuable one for me, it was also one that I felt a bit ambivalent about, knowing that if it lived up to its expectations, the institution could be so much more than what it is. So I started wrestling with the idea of a book, and specifically the book focuses on the construction of gender, that is, how masculinity and femininity are formed and reinforced and challenged within these specific institutions. Because after all, these are gendered clubs, segregated gendered clubs. And so that's how the book began, just being entrenched within these organizations and beginning to give a lot of thought to what was right, and perhaps most importantly, what was wrong about these institutions and how we could implement some change to make the Greek system a better, healthier outlet for young men and women who are leaving for college for the first time, trying to define themselves and create a sense of identity about who they are for the future.
Yeah, you made a comment just a second ago about this book looking at the white Greek system, and I want to address that just a second. There is also a sort of a separate black Greek system.
Oh, very much so. And in fact, in writing this book, I had to be very careful about the focus of the book and who I could and could not get access to. And so being a white male and being a past member of a white fraternity, gaining access to these groups was relatively easy. For black fraternities and sororities, however, there are, in many respects, different institutions, and they were created for different reasons, and to this day they are still motivated by primarily different reasons, with different goals and different cultures and climates within each organization. So as a result, I was very clear about, at least for this project, focusing solely on white organizations. Now, I have an article coming out soon in Greg Parks' new book on black fraternities and sororities, in which I analyze homophobia within black Greek systems. But for this book, it was very important for me to stay focused on the issue of gender, because that's the focus of the book, and then for later research, begin to expand it on issues of race and gender.
I want to talk about the gender issues in the book. I found it to be really interesting because it seems to me that if you took the references to the fraternities and sororities out of the book, you'd have a pretty compelling study of gender roles on college campuses today, you know, regardless of whether or not the students chose to go Greek.
Right. Well, it's interesting. A lot of times people say, what's the book about? And I say, well, in a very general sense, the book talks about how young men and women on college campuses conceive of each other and gender and dating and body image and violence and aggression and their futures. I think the one thing that separates the general public from the Greek public, and one of the arguments I make in the book, is that at least in the elite organizations, we have almost gender on steroids, what I call hypermasculinity and hyperfemininity. And so many of the dominant motifs and themes we find in Greek houses, you'd find throughout the nation. I mean, that's one thing about gender. It's relatively stable, but perhaps the most disturbing thing for me in that these most elite and coveted organizations, we find an accentuated sense of a gender identity, where masculinity is hyper-masculine and femininity is an exaggerated form of, at times, some of the most dangerous ideas of femininity.
Talk for a second. You just mentioned the elite organizations, and you actually break the fraternities and sororities down into three categories.
Yes. I thought it was very important that that readers keep in mind that the Greek experience is not monolithic. It's not as if all Greeks are the same. And one of the things that I had always found quite remarkable about my experience within Greek systems was that how they differentiated from one another depending upon how elite and coveted they were. And so one of the arguments I make in the book is that, generally speaking, we can look at Greek systems, big Greek systems, being divided within three categories. And so the first category would be the elite categories. And this goes for fraternities and sororities. And it's these elite organizations that are the biggest, the wealthiest, the oldest, that produce the most influential alums. And these are, of course, the most well-known. These are the folks that produce the student presidents and the homecoming kings and queens. There's a middle tier. It's a very interesting group, and I label these the aspirers. And these are the groups that are smaller, that can't quite afford to be as an elitist and privileged, are poor. Many times they're younger in their traditions. And then finally, there's a group of fraternities and sororities on campus, and I label these the strugglers. And these are the really small groups that are struggling to get members, that are struggling for money. In fact, most of these don't even have fraternity houses or sorority houses. So within the larger Greek system, I think we can really think of a tripartite system. The interesting thing about this system, though, is that as we move up from the strugglers into the aspirers and into the elites, we fall into a far more rigid idea of gender. And so, believe it or not, here's kind of the irony behind it. The elite organizations that people really, really want to get in and that are far more competitive to get in have a far more rigid idea of gender acceptability. That is, there's far less leeway for deviance outside of traditional gender ideas. And as we move down into the ranks of the aspirers and the strugglers, in many ways we find organizations that are far more tolerant and accepting of difference. And I'm a firm believer that the college experience should be a place where we expand our ideas and push our borders of what's acceptable. And in some ways, then, the aspirers and the strugglers give a whole lot more freedom to their young members to challenge very traditional ideas of identity and masculinity and femininity than the elites.
Well, I think that's interesting. Going back many years to when I was in college, I remember girls who were rushing sororities, and if they did not get a bid from the sorority, most especially if they were pledging an elite sorority,
right,
if they did not get a bid from that sorority or the top of the next tier, then they would turn down their bids instead
it happens quite often here.
You know, instead of going to the struggling, so to speak.
Right. It happens quite often here. And it's been a nice experience that since I've been researching and writing this book, I have been interviewed by quite a few parents, concerned parents, about the Greek system and about advice for their sons and daughters. And one of the pieces of advice I give them is that we can't lump all Greeks into the same common experience, and that your son or daughter may not be enthused about not getting invited into the most elite of these groups. But that's only a surface understanding of these groups. In fact, what I have found is that in some of these smaller aspirer and struggler groups, that brotherhood and sisterhood is wonderful. It's a much smaller group, and so the brothers and sisters actually know each other a lot better. So, for example, there's a chapter in the book about eating disorders in sororities, and what I found out is there's a direct relationship between how elite and coveted a sorority is and eating disorders. Girls, for example, in struggling houses and aspire houses seem to have better concepts of body image and have a better relationship with food.
I found that that section to be fascinating, that even the level of the percentage of girls who are dieting or addicted to exercise is higher in the elite sororities and then goes down depending on where you go into the chain in the sorority. The assumption can be made that the girls in the sororities that are sort of struggling actually have a better body image.
They do. They seem to be generally happier. One of the wonderful things about working with the Greek system, too, is that I get to know my students both inside and outside the classroom. And so I'm able to spend quality time with my Greek and non-Greek students as well during dinners and lunches and breakfasts. And going to an aspirer or struggler house is always a whole lot more pleasant, specifically in sororities, because there are still places where they enjoy food. Many, many stories, many, of course, were very heartbreaking for me, being a father of a young daughter, but many stories about how unhealthy living in an elite sorority house is. And so many of these women say that once they move out of the house, they're able to regain their lives back. But part of the problem is some of the most beautiful women on campus that are constantly concerned about body image and body shape are now cohabitating within a very small proximity of one another. And so thinness begins to breed thinness, and obsessiveness about body weight begins to create an overwhelming sense that weight, thinness, and body shape is the key factor in defining these young girls' lives. So once these girls move out of the house and get apartments with friends, almost across the board, all these women from elite organizations said that they had a better relationship with food, they enjoyed food a whole lot more, and that life, at least the dietary life of these women, became far more balanced.
Now, you found that it's the same is starting to become true for the boys or the men, young men.
Yeah, this was maybe one of the most interesting shifts for someone of my age. I'm 44, and I pledged exactly 25 years ago this fall. But when I was pledging a fraternity at James Madison, elite fraternity members really didn't worry too much about body shape. That just about no one went to the gym. In fact, the only people that went to the gym were NCAA athletes. And as long as you remained relatively toned, that was enough. One of the things that has amazed me is that now our young boys, specifically once again in elite organizations, are becoming as obsessed about their body shape and image as the women. I make a remark that in a book that one place that we find gender equality in the Greek system is that men are now becoming equally annoyed and obsessed and concerned about their body shape as women. The only difference is he's trying to get larger and larger and she's trying to get smaller and smaller. And so in many of these elite houses, it's not uncommon to find 70% of the house regularly going to gyms and going to tanning beds and shaving their bodies. I'm using supplements to begin to shape and tone their figures. And most of your listening audience, if they ever go to public pools or are ever around young men and women during the summers, probably have noticed that young men and women are looking a whole lot different, specifically the men in this case, than we ever had back in the 70s and 80s and 90s.
Well, Alan DeSantis, thank you for your time today.
Well, thank you.
That was WFPL's Robin Fisher speaking with author and University of Kentucky professor Alan DeSantis about his first book, Inside Greek You, Fraternities, Sororities, and the Pursuit of Pleasure, Power, and Prestige. For more information, visit our website, WFPL.org, and click on Studio 619. The Grobmeier Award in Music is one of the most prestigious honors available to composers. The 2007 winner is Peter Lieberson, a composer born in New York but now living in Santa Fe. His winning composition, Neruda Song, sets five sonnets of Pablo Neruda and was composed for his late wife and singer, Lorraine Hunt Lieberson. Classical 90.5's Daniel Gillum interviewed Mr. Lieberson by phone and talked about winning the award and his winning composition.
Pablo Neruda hasn't been set by many composers, and the other well-known setting, I think, was by Barber. So it's not a composer we hear, or a poet we hear about often being set by American composers, at least. Tell us how you settled on this author and these texts.
I was traveling by myself. Lorraine Hunt Lieberson and I got together as a couple in 1997, when she sang in my opera, Ashoka's Dream, which I composed for the Santa Fe Opera Company. And we became a couple during that summer. And I was traveling by myself. I think Lorraine was performing somewhere. And I was traveling back to Albuquerque en route to Santa Fe to see my mother, who at that time was still alive and living in Santa Fe, as was Lorraine's sister living in Santa Fe, which was also a kind of unusual coincidence.
Mm-hmm.
I was passing by a bookstore in the airport, and for some reason I went in, and I was drawn to a book that had a really shocking pink cover with orange dots on it. And I was just drawn to it, and I picked it up, and it said Neruda Love Sonnets. And I started thumbing through the book, and I was immediately taken by the beauty of the poetry and what was and the emotions that were being expressed. Neruda wrote 100 love sonnets to his wife, Mathilde. And it was a translation with the Spanish on one side and the English on the other, and I thought, I really have to set some of these for Lorraine one day. And I bought the book. And when we got together, Lorraine was fluent in Spanish, and she would read them to me. I'm not a Spanish speaker. But I got them in my ears, and the commission for it really was circuitous because I had been asked by Esa-Pekka Salonen and the L.A. Philharmonic to write a concerto for one of their first chair players. And apparently that whole commissioning series got pared down to fewer and fewer composers. And finally I realized I didn't want to write another concerto. I've written quite a lot of concertos, 3 piano concertos, a cello concerto, viola concerto, and I thought, that's really, I've had enough.
Mm-hmm.
And so I asked, this was a number of years later, whether I could write a song cycle for Lorraine. And Esa-Pekka and the New York the L.A. Philharmonic said, great. And as it turned out, the Boston Symphony joined in as a co-commissioner with James Levine. And that's how the piece got recorded, actually, because the premiere took place in May 05 in Los Angeles, and then 6 months later in November of 05, it was played in Boston. And they have a wonderful recording setup. So they record all of their live concerts, and that's how these songs were recorded and finally released on Nonesuch.
So you chose to set them in Spanish.
Oh, yes.
And was that difficult, not being a Spanish speaker? And
no.
It wasn't at all?
No, it wasn't. In fact, I had them in my ears because Lorraine read them to me. And Spanish is a very beautiful musical language. And I set the Rilke songs, this whole cycle I wrote for Lorraine, in German as well. And I'm not a German speaker. My mother was German-Norwegian, and she would read Rilke to me when I was a boy. So I actually found Spanish easier to set than English. English is a very difficult language to set musically, and so I was happy to set them in Spanish.
That was Daniel Gillum from Classical 90.5 talking with Peter Lieberson, the 2007 Grawemeyer Award winner in music composition. The Neruda songs were composed for his wife Lorraine Hunt Lieberson, a world-renowned singer who succumbed to cancer in 2006. She premiered the winning compositions with the Los Angeles Philharmonic and the Boston Symphony Orchestra. More information about today's show is available online at WFPL.org. You can email us from there or listen to previous broadcasts in our audio archive. You can also write to us at Studio 619, 619 South 4th Street, Louisville, Kentucky, 40202. Or you can reach us by phone at 502-814-6500. Studio 619 is produced by the Public Radio Partnership. Everything you hear on Studio 619 is compiled by the staff at PRP, which includes WFPL, WFPK, and WUOL. We also air submissions from Kentucky Public Radio, collaboration of all the public radio stations in the Commonwealth. I'm Rick Howlett. Join us next time for another edition of Studio 619 on WFPL.